sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows and TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own? Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? There are lives in the balance. There are people under fire.
There are lives in the balance. Yes, indeed. That is so true. That is so true. That was the folk singer Richie Havens with Lives in the Balance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, November the 19th, and we are going to be continuing the theme from the previous show, Gary's Show. We are taking a look at developments in Gaza. As we speak, the Israeli government has made it clear that it is prepared to engage in a full-scale ground war in order, it says, to stem the rocket attacks from Hamas strongholds in Gaza. But we will be learning from a guest very shortly that there is something that we need to know about where things stand right now, and we will get into it in deeper. She will tell us very briefly. And then we will listen to a very instructive backgrounder from a peace activist whose father was a general in the Israeli army that fought or helped to orchestrate the 6 Days War of 1967, when Israel won, quote-unquote, the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and Sinai. Our guest is Phyllis Bennis. Thanks, Phyllis, for joining us. Phyllis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Thanks, Phyllis. Good
to
have
you.
Well, I know you've been following this very, very closely. What do you understand the situation to be right now?
The situation on the ground is dramatically worse. There was another attack just a few hours ago on the main media complex in Gaza City. Several more journalists were killed. A number of children were killed and injured this morning again. I think the critical aspect we have to look at is the role of the United States. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak had it right yesterday. He said directly, quote, "This effort could not have been concluded without the generous and consistent support of the American administration led by President Obama." That's the bottom line. This is definitely something that has been enabled by the U.S. Certainly the weapons that Israel is using are produced and paid for in the U.S. and by U.S. taxpayers, whether that be F-16 bombers, Apache helicopters, armored Caterpillar bulldozers. In those brief moments of respite when Gazans look out their window, what they see is the weapons of war manufactured and paid for here in the United States. So we are very definitely being held accountable for the U.S. role in this. Now, we hear that in the negotiations underway in Cairo, the effort towards an immediate ceasefire, that there is a U.S. diplomatic team on the ground trying to help orchestrate that. That's a good thing to hear, but it flies in the face of the public statements from President Obama and others who have said explicitly that Israel has the right of what they call self-defense, and that the only pressure that needs to happen is pressure from Egypt or Turkey on Hamas to stop its rocket fire. No equivalent pressure is to be brought to bear on Israel to stop its far more deadly fire, which as of now, as of at least a couple of hours ago, had killed more than 90 Palestinians, more than half of them civilians, and half of those women and children, at least 10, I believe, journalists. The injuries are over 800, many of them very serious. One journalist had to have one leg amputated. So this is a disastrous humanitarian impact on Gaza, where people have nowhere to run, no protection. It's a good thing that in Israel only 3 people have been killed in all these days of rockets. The rockets are far better at terrorizing people and frightening people than they are at killing people. That's obviously a good thing. But in Gaza, there's no such distinction. What terrorizes also kills. And what we're seeing is a massive attack on a civilian population, which is an occupied population, which under international law is supposed to be protected by the occupying power. Instead, we're seeing it as the target of the occupying power. If we look at, you know, the timing of this, Utrecht, certainly the decision to wage war again in Gaza, this time 4 years after the last time, has been a long time in the making. There was a statement just about a year ago from the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, General Benny Gantz, when he said that there would soon need to be another, what he called, swift and painful attack on Gaza to restore what he called Israel's power of deterrence. So this offensive is clearly very long planned, but the specific timing probably has a lot to do with the Israeli elections that are coming up in January. Netanyahu is running again, and he has antagonized a lot of Israelis because of his continuing to diss President Obama. He has really developed a very tense and hostile relationship between Obama and Netanyahu. But this was able to put him in the position where, of course, the Obama administration unfortunately took the bait and immediately went out there in the old U.S. position that was perhaps more valid before the Arab Spring transformed the region, a period of absolute uncritical support for anything Israel does. That's still the U.S. position. The problem is right now that doesn't match public opinion in the U.S., and it certainly doesn't match the political conditions in the Arab world. It's interesting to note that in a new poll that was taken just yesterday by CNN, while there is still significant U.S. popular support for Israel in the sense of sympathy towards Israel, there is also a sense that the support among Democrats in particular has really diminished, so that you have now 41% of Democrats believe that Israel is justified in what it's doing in Gaza, as opposed to 4 years ago during the CAF-led operation when 52% of Democrats supported it. So it's more than 10% drop. That's quite significant, and it could become quite dangerous for President Obama as the issue of Israel becomes a far more partisan issue, with Republicans far more pro-Israeli than Democrats, and President Obama increasingly out of step with his own party base.
This seems also to provide a very worthwhile, if you will, a platform for Netanyahu to basically begin an initiative that eventually will come to include Iran, and by extension, get the United States involved with a war with Iran, which seems
well,
to have been his initial goal.
I don't have time to get into the details of it. As I had mentioned, I'm going to have to be off the air in one minute. But I think it is certainly a possibility that one of the aspects that Netanyahu is looking at is the possibility that he is undermining Hamas's military capacity, which I think he may still want to claim. I don't think it's true, but he may want to claim that that could represent a threat to Israel in the context of an Israeli attack on Iran that might see, in his view, Hamas responding against Israel as if they were nothing but a puppet of Iran, which is simply not the case. Hamas has become far more independent with the Arab Spring. It broke with the Syrian government entirely. It has much more distant relationship with Iran, although still some relationship. And its relations now are closest with Egypt and Turkey, two countries that are critical allies of the United States.
And well, thanks, Phyllis. I don't want to deter you. I know you are involved in some very serious work at the moment relating to the situation, but I want to thank you for taking this time to talk with us today, and we'll talk again
thank
very,
you.
Very soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. That was Phyllis Bennis, who has been very active in the process of brokering a peace, if you will, and organizing with a number of other like-minded groups to force the Israeli government to basically amend its position of just aggravating situations in the Middle East, and by extension involving the United States in a lot of it. We don't need to be there necessarily, but we'll be watching that. But what I want to do is I'll take a break very shortly, and I want us to listen very carefully to what you're about to hear. It's a presentation about, it gives a historical perspective, but in a very interesting way. The presenter is Miko Peled. He's a peace activist. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. And his father, Matti Peled, was an Israeli army general who helped to orchestrate the attack on Arab armies in the Six-Day War of 1967, in which Israel claimed the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and the Sinai. And he posits, in fact, he says very clearly that the skirmishes and the warfare and the militarism and the conflicts, particularly between Israel and the Palestinian world and the Arab world generally, has at its root, he says, a Zionist perspective on emptying that portion that Israel now occupies, emptying it. And we heard from last week when we played tape, we heard about the process of what happens. It's usually comes in a three-step program. You invade, then you occupy, and then you transform. We heard that. So let us take this very short break. We'll hear a bit from other programs to promote the other programs on PRN. We come back to that presentation right after this.
There are shadows on the faces of the men who send the gun to those wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. I want to know who these men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never around to fight or to die. There are lies in the balance.
There are lies in the balance as we speak today. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. We're about to hear a presentation given by a peace activist, Miko Peled, and this was done, Miko Peled, sorry. This was a speech he gave in Seattle just last month. And he was talking about the Zionist paradigm and whether there's new hope or any reason for hope. And if there is, what is it for the Israeli-Palestine conflict? So we listen to Miko Peled.
This whole issue of Israel and Palestine is covered in so much myth. And there's so much double standard when people talk about this issue. And I'll give you two examples. I don't know if you heard Bibi Netanyahu's speech at the United Nations. I heard it, not live, but after he actually delivered it. And he began it with probably the two most striking examples of myth and double standard. And he began by talking about the right of return of the Jews to their ancient homeland. And of course, the Jews that returned, so-called, returned to their homeland were not exactly the same Jews who were expelled from their homeland, right? Because these were expelled a couple of thousand years before that. These were not their descendants either, because this has been a very long time. So these are people, the people that actually came back, so to speak, are people that claim some kind of a heritage, some kind of a connection, a relationship to the ancient Hebrews. And they claimed that they had the right to return to their homeland, and this is what Zionism was about, and this was you know, accepted by the world as the right. They had the right to return. Now, if we talk about the right of return of one nation, you'd expect that there would be, if we accept it as a principle, then you'd expect that we'd accept it in general, across the board. Yet when people talk about the right of return of Palestinians to their homeland, suddenly a red line comes up and everybody says, no, we can't talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. This has to be taken off the table. This is not negotiable. The right of return of the Palestinians is not acceptable. What's interesting about that is that the right of return of the Palestinians, we're talking about, quite often we talk about the actual people who had to leave their homes. And if they had already passed away, then we're talking about their direct descendants. People who still have the keys and the deeds to their homes, and quite often can go to the very spot where a village existed, where today there might be a highway, and will point out the mosque, and will point out the well, and will point out the door to their home. Yet they do not enjoy the right to return. So obviously, this is a double standard of immense proportions. The other thing Bibi talked about right off as he started was about King David, who reigned some 3,000 years ago, and, you know, and here we are today as his descendants. What's interesting is, besides the fact that there is no historical evidence that King David ever existed outside the Bible, which of course is not a historical document, and Israeli archaeologists have all but turned up the entire country to find proof that he ever existed. Today, as we speak, an entire town, an entire community is being kicked out of their homes and forced into exile through violence in order to prove that King David existed in a place called Silwan. It's a community of 50,000 people right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. Yet the world sees nothing wrong with this. American money is poured into this project to build what is called the New City of David, an archaeological park. And a community of 50,000 Palestinians has to be terrorized in order to leave. Their homes are being destroyed in order to make this point, this fictional, mythical connection between the ancient kingdom of King David and today's Israel. So these are just two examples. And it was interesting that Bibi Netanyahu decided to kick off his speech at the United Nations with these two things. But what I'd like to do today is just begin with a little bit of history. And if you go ahead, hit the first slide. Thank you. People talk about the fact that this conflict, the conflict in the Holy Land, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has been around for so long that it's really not something anybody can ever solve. It's been going on for thousands of years. People have been killing each other there forever. This is not true. And a good place to start, if we're going to talk about how this conflict began, a good place to start would be on the 29th of November, 1947. The day that United Nations accepted the resolution to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And this ridiculous map is what they came up with. Now, when you look at this map, before you even hear about the details, before we even touch on the details of this map, just by looking at it, it's unbelievable that anybody expected that this would work. And of course, this didn't even last one day. In 1947, there were two communities living parallel lives. We had the Jewish community that numbered about 500,000, maybe a little bit less than 500,000, that were expecting and hoping to become a state. And you had the Arab community, the Palestinian Arab community, of about 1.5 million people who were also in the process and had the expectation of becoming a state. Yet when the United Nations came up with this ridiculous plan, they chose to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller community, to the Jewish community. And the smaller portion of the land to the larger community. And then people said, and to this day you hear people say, see, the Arabs, the Palestinians, did not accept the partition plan, so all this is their fault. Is anybody mad enough to think that they would accept this? Would anybody in their Palestine, in their place, have accepted something like this? Obviously not. And obviously, like I said, this did not last even a single day. Because as soon as the resolution was accepted, the Zionist forces, what was called the Haganah, the Palmach, began a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing. Now the story that we hear, the myth that we're told about 1947, and I heard it once again today, earlier today, at the Seattle Times, is that in 1947, after the United Nations finally recognized the right of the Jewish people to have their own state, the Arab armies attacked, intending to destroy this fledgling state, this young Jewish community. And this is only several years after the Nazi Holocaust. Yet somehow, between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948, the Zionist forces were able to conquer almost 80% of the country, destroy over 500 towns and villages, including schools and mosques and churches and homes, and exile almost a million people within a 12-month period. How did they do this if they were being attacked by massive armies from the outside? But once again, when we look at the facts, we realize that in 1947, the Jewish community, the Zionist community, had quite a substantial military force. They had a force of close to 40,000 armed men, well-trained, well-indoctrinated. My father was one of them. There was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians have never had a military force. To this day, the Palestinians have never had an army or a military force. There was no equivalent of the other side. The Arab armies, such as they were, didn't enter the war until late in May of 1948. Much of the ethnic cleansing had already taken place. The war had been taking place for over 6 months by then. So, of course, this is a myth. This is a myth that nobody takes the time to investigate and question. But once again, the reality that in a 12-month period, so much was done, exactly because that is exactly what was the purpose of these Zionist forces. To capture as much of the land as possible and get rid of as many people as possible. And that's exactly what they did. Would you hit the next one, please? You heard the story, Judith related to the story about my mother. That's my mother. She's 86 now. She's still living in Jerusalem. She was born and raised in Jerusalem. And she used to tell me how when she was young, she would walk around on a Saturday afternoon. And many of the beautiful neighborhoods in Jerusalem, and I'm talking about the new Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that was built outside the city walls. These were Palestinian communities with beautiful homes. And she would walk around and she would see the families on a Saturday afternoon sitting under the, or by the lemon tree and so on. Yet, and then in 1948, she was living still in Jerusalem. These communities were forced to leave. Their homes were given to Israeli families. And she was offered one of these homes, and like you heard, she refused. The thought of taking another family's home just did not sit well with her. And then she saw the looting, and she still, to this day, when she talks about it, you can see that she feels such a sense of shame. But what's interesting is that I remember hearing this story as a child many, many years ago and over a very long period of time. And it wasn't until I was actually working on the book and I spoke to her about this again that I realized why this story was bothering me all those years. Because the story was bothering me. There was something about it that was troubling. And only now I realized it was troubling because it contradicted the national narrative. It contradicted what I learned in school. That the Arabs attacked, we won, they left, and we get the spoils. So what's wrong with taking their homes? If this is the truth, then there's no wrong in taking their homes. They attacked, and we won. It's fair enough. But once again, like I said, hearing this story in the back of my mind over and over and over again kind of troubled me. And this is exactly why. The truth lays in the personal story, not in the national narrative. Can you hit the next one, please? The title of the book is The General Son, and then the subtitle is journey of an Israeli in Palestine. So the general's son is a big part of who I am, and this is my father as a general. Now, after the State of Israel was established and the Jewish militia, the Zionist militia, became the Israeli army, he remained as an officer and had a very long and, you know, interesting military career. 20 years later, 1967, the drums of war were beating. He was already a general. And a lot has been written about what happened in 1967 and why the war broke out and who actually started the war and why. A lot of books have been written about this, movies have been made about this, and it's an interesting period. Now, just kind of to touch on the history, some of you I'm sure recall, the Egyptian President Nasser decided to kick out the UN peacekeeping forces that were in the Sinai Peninsula that divided Egypt from Israel. And he entered against the ceasefire agreement that existed between the countries. He entered Egyptian troops into the Sinai Peninsula. A general saw this as a cause for war, as a legitimate cause for war. And they pushed for war. The Israeli cabinet, however, they were hesitant. They were not so eager to start a war. And this tug of war began between these two groups. It was a very interesting difference between these two groups because the cabinet members were older. They were in their late 60s, early 70s, most of them. They were born in exile. They came with this whole baggage of exile, of pogroms. And, you know, this is only 25 years after the Holocaust. And they carried all this. And they were worried that a war might lead to another Holocaust. The generals, however, were in their early 40s. Almost all of them were born in Palestine. Almost all of them were members of the Zionist militia in 1948. And they were what I like to call the new Jew that the Zionists wanted to create. Full of testosterone and very assertive and willing and ready to fight. And they created the Israeli army. Well, they wanted to fight. They saw an opportunity to start another war. Now, the myth that we're told about this, or the story, I should say, that we're told about the 1967 war, is that once again, Israel was attacked by three massive armies intending to destroy it. And once again, miraculously, somehow, we, the Israelis, prevailed. Because we're smarter, and because we're better trained, and we're more motivated, and as we heard now recently, we're somehow culturally superior as well, perhaps. Who knows? But for all these reasons, we prevailed, and we defeated the Arab armies. Once again, when I was working on the book, I decided to go into the Israeli army archives to learn about my father's career. Like I said, he had a very, very interesting military career. And I was interested particularly in reading the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the 1967 war. Now, once again, a lot has been written about those meetings. So I wasn't expecting to find anything new, because I'd read everything that was out there. But as soon as I began reading, I saw something that I'd not seen anywhere else. My father says this, and several of the other generals say this, in their attempt to convince the cabinet to start the war. And that is that the Egyptian army is not prepared for war. And therefore, we must attack now. In fact, they said, the Egyptian army needs at least a year and a half to 2 years before it will be prepared for war. So we have a tremendous opportunity now to once again, this will be the third time, to destroy the Egyptian army. And the fact that the Egyptian army brought their troops into Sinai and closer to us, closer to Israel, only makes it easier for us to destroy them. Not only are they not talking about an existential threat, they're not talking about any threat. They're talking about an opportunity, a military opportunity to once again defeat the Egyptian army. So once again, the myth fizzles away. The generals, of course, won the day. The government gave them the okay to start a preemptive strike against Egypt. The Egyptian army was decimated in a couple of days. The Sinai Peninsula was conquered once again. The Gaza Strip was conquered. And the generals wanted more. The generals wanted more. They wanted the West Bank, which was a sore spot for them because in 1948 they wanted to take it. They were young commanders in 1948, and they wanted the West Bank then. But for political reasons, Israel decided not to take it. Well, here was their opportunity, and they took the West Bank. And they'd wanted the Golan Heights for a long time, too, because it's high up above the Galilee, and it's, you know, there's lots of water there. And they took that as well. And there was a lot of ambition, too. The generals, the northern commander wanted the Golan Heights, the central commander wanted, you know, they all wanted the laurels of victory. They had no doubt that they were going to be victorious. In six days, the Israeli army defeated and destroyed three Arab armies, conquered the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, killed over 15,000 Arab soldiers at a loss of 700 soldiers to the Israeli army. 15,000 to 700, that's quite a ratio. And all this was done in 6 days as Arab armies were attacking them.
True.
That's another one of those stories that nobody talks about, the USS Liberty, that's right. So, again, the myth fizzles away once you actually take a look at the facts. Now, my father did something very interesting. After the war was over, at the very first meeting of the generals, the very first weekly meeting, he stood up and he said, "Now we have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian question. We can now offer the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza. If we do this, this will be the first Arab state with which Israel will have a peace agreement. It'll be a bridge for peace agreements with the other Arab countries, since Palestine, of course, was always a central issue. And we can go on living, you know, being the democratic Jewish state that we want it to be." And as he was saying this, a massive settlement project and an ethnic cleansing project began in the West Bank. Hundreds of thousands were thrown out. Towns and villages and cities were destroyed. And new towns were being built and highways and so on and infrastructure to bring Israelis into the West Bank. Just as Israel had done after 1948, destroying Palestinian towns and villages, changing the names and building towns and villages for Israelis, the same thing was done in the West Bank after 1967. For Israel, this meant the job was done. In essence, what they did was they erased Palestine off the map. I always like to show this picture. This is the victory lap. These are all the generals standing after the war, young, you know, victorious. And in the center is Zalman Shazar, who is the president of the State of Israel. You know, Israel has a president as kind of a symbolic figure. Somebody who used to be a, you know, something important in his lifetime. And you see the old generation and the new generation. And this new generation of generals is often referred to as the silver tray upon which the land of Israel was given to the Jewish people. Because from that point on, the entire land of Israel was under Jewish control for the first time after 2,000 years and only 25 years after the Holocaust. Historically, from a Zionist perspective, this is unbelievable, unprecedented. But in fact, this is what they did. Palestine was erased completely from the map, and Israel was in completely over the entire map. This was the objective. This was the name of the game. Erasing Palestine, getting rid of the people, and de-Arabizing the country. De-Arabizing the country is what was left to do. That's why when people talk about the possibility of Israel somehow giving up the West Bank for a Palestinian state, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. It shows a complete misunderstanding of the objective of Zionism and the Jewish state, and the Zionist state. Because conquering the land was the first objective. Getting rid of the people and then de-Arabizing. And when I say de-Arabizing the country, this country has a 1,500-year-old history of Arab and Muslim rule. It was an Arab and a Muslim country more than it was anything else in history. So that has to be destroyed. Monuments have to be destroyed. Names have to be changed. The history has to be rewritten to connect once again King David to today's Israel and completely disregard the fact that this is in fact an Arab country. That it is in fact in the center of the Arab world. And that in fact over half of the population are Arabs. Now, after my father retired from the military, he did something even more stunning. He dedicated the rest of his life to the creation of a Palestinian state and peace with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and he advocated for equal rights for the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. Two things which are yet to be achieved. Now, in the mid-1970s, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, this started contacting my father and others, or Avneri and others, people who were like that, in order to begin a dialogue. And that is really when the notion of the two-state solution was put together. These were Yasser Arafat's top people, his advisors and his ambassadors and so on. In this picture is my father with Dr. Issam Sartawi, who was the Palestinian ambassador, the PLO ambassador to Paris. He was later killed in 1983. And this dialogue went on between official representatives of the PLO and, on the Israeli side, these were renegades. These are people who used to hold, high office of one kind or another, and they were Zionist Israelis. But the Israeli government refused to take part in any of this. Only in 1993 did the Israeli government agree to finally begin negotiating with the Palestinians. What happened? What changed? Well, what changed was they accomplished their mission of making the conquest of the West Bank irreversible. By 1993, the Israeli government knew for certain that a Palestinian state could not be established in the West Bank. The settlements were there, billions were invested. The entire Jordan River Valley was settled with villages and kibbutzim and things like that. There were major cities already built in the West Bank. Entire East Jerusalem was taken over by Israel. There was no place anymore for a Palestinian state to be established. And that is when Israel said, okay, we will begin negotiations. So they allowed Arafat to come, misleading him into thinking that they were really intending to make peace and basically trying to force him to sign an agreement that would complete his surrender. But once again, when we hear people still talking about the notion that somehow there could be an Israeli government that would give up the West Bank for a Palestinian state, like I said, if it wasn't so sad and tragic, it would be funny. Because as we look at the 65-year history of the State of Israel, it is absolutely clear that this can never happen. Now, later on in the year 2000, I'm sure you recall, President Clinton invited Barak and Arafat to Camp David to somehow solidify a peace agreement. Or so he said. What they tried to do is force Arafat once again to surrender, which he would not do. So they came out of Camp David, and President Clinton said, Arafat gave some, Barak gave more. In other words, this is Arafat's fault. And from that moment on, for the last 4 years of his life, he was vilified, and eventually Arafat died with Israeli tanks surrounding his office under siege. But the myth that we're always told is that the Palestinians are not willing to make concessions. And that is the problem. I think Mitt Romney alluded to this as well in that little secret tape that was recorded. The problem is the Palestinians. They just don't want peace. Yasser Arafat was willing to give up almost 80% of his homeland and the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homeland and be compensated, all for the sake of peace. What he wouldn't do is he wouldn't go less than 20%. He wouldn't give up the West Bank and the Gaza. That he couldn't do. They want him to give up even more. They want him to sign a surrender agreement, and he wouldn't. It's not the Palestinians that aren't willing to make concessions. It's Israel that's incapable of making concessions, because concessions on the land are impossible from a Zionist perspective. The whole name of the game is taking the land and making it ours. And this is exactly the process that took place. Please.
Well, that gives us a very, very good backdrop for continuing discussions on the conflict, wouldn't you say? We have some time to take your calls and questions at 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. This is just a briefing to give us a sense of the behind-the-scenes developments as delivered by Miko Peled, whose father, Matti Peled, was an Israeli army general who helped to orchestrate the attack on Arab armies in the Six-Day War of 1967. Miko Peled is the author of a newly published book, The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. 1-888-874-4888. We have some time to take your questions and comments before the program closes out. I think it is always important to appreciate an insider's point of view, because that what we just heard, we would not easily get access to that kind of information. He was born and raised in Jerusalem, and his father played an integral part in the events that led to the establishment of the Israeli state. But he talks about the three-pronged program, and we heard about it here before. Just last week, we talked about that. The three-pronged process, he said, is to conquer the land, get rid of the people, and then de-Arabize it. So when we hear about all these talks and all the differences of opinion and the diplomatic initiatives and the high-level negotiations and all of that, it boils down to this three-pronged program of a Zionist state. It was significant that he started out by discussing the emphasis that was made by Netanyahu at the General Assembly address of linking this current state of Israel to its predestined role. And he talked about trying to establish a link with King David. And it is on this basis, the idea of Zionism is that, of course, the land was given, this is by biblical fiat, that they should occupy this land. And so the effort here, no matter how complicated it is made to look, no matter how intricate it is made to look, Miko Peled tells us at the foundation of it all is a three-pronged program. Conquer the land, get rid of the people, and de-Arabize it. And in this regard, it closely resembles a lot of similar situations all over the world. We've heard them called, it's called ethnic cleansing. It's called forced migrations. It's called all kinds of things. It's called apartheid. It's called all kinds of things. But essentially, the fight is about land. Why? Because the basis of all nationhood is land. You fight for land. Because when you have the land, you have what's on it, what's in it, what's under it, what's over it, even what's around it. And that In 1947, the United Nations should agree to just arbitrarily just go in and carve up Palestine. Say, you know what, we could do that. And the basis for it was, these folks don't have an army. They're not going to resist. And even if they do, it is a kind of resistance that we can beat them at. It becomes something like the U.S. invasion of Grenada. And, you know, we had to invade Grenada. You don't have to invade Grenada. But it had to be done that way because everybody knows that there wasn't going to be any real resistance from a small country like that with very few resources. So the attack or the concentration, even by the international community, this is when we begin to appreciate how people would feel about the Western world. Because it was the Western world that conspired to just arbitrarily carve up somebody's land, somebody's home, somebody's homeland, somebody's heritage, and drive you out and take it over. And do so by force and flout international law, flout even the covenants that you sign off on. Today, President Obama is in the East talking about the law, international laws governing humanitarianism and so forth. That's the irony of it. There was a conspiracy by international elements in the West, in Europe and the United States, to just simply decide in 1947, we're going to take this piece of real estate. And if anybody puts up a fight among all of us, we have the wherewithal to obliterate them. So we will have our way. And so they did. And so they did. So that's our briefing for today. We'll return to each other tomorrow. I'm sure the conversation will continue then. And I want to thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Please feel free to drop me a note, drop me a line. I take the time to respond as quickly as I possibly can. And that is at leadstories@gmail.com. And stay tuned. Coming right up is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Thank you so much. See you tomorrow. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. Might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war.